This episode is brought to you by GetMobile ID, the smart choice for MDL implementations. Put citizens in control with GetMobile ID. Fully ISO compliant and UL certified for all transaction modes. Learn more at getgroupna.com. Welcome to AmbaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Amba community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, we are talking about a new topic that we've not talked about on the AmbaCast before, which is working with tribal authorities and how our members do that in their jurisdictions. And to join me today for the conversation, I'm pleased to welcome two new voices on our AmbaCast, James Manuel, the Federal and Tribal Liaison from the Washington Department of Licensing, and Captain Rick Roberts from the Alaska State Troopers. Gentlemen, welcome to the AmbaCast.
Thanks for having us
here. Yeah, thank you.
So it's an interesting topic, and I'm going to share some background with our listeners to set the context, which is that there are 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States with about 2.5 million individuals. And in Canada, there's actually 634 First Nation governments across Canada. Most of those are in Ontario and British Columbia. But all to say, in general, I think sometimes we underestimate the scope of this population and don't really appreciate the presence they have. And on an unfortunate note, when it comes to traffic safety, they are a very vulnerable population. In fact, according to NHTSA, Native Americans are 2 to 3 more times likely to die in a car crash than other ethnic groups. And it's the leading cause of death for American Indians and Alaska Natives. Motor vehicle crashes is the leading cause of death, according to the CDC. So that's some sombering news that I'm not sure people appreciate the risk of this population. So with that context, James, let me start with you in the Department of Licensing. I'm not sure many members are even aware that most or many of our members have dedicated programs to work with these to work with the recognized tribes. So give me a little sense, at least to your aware, is this something that the Washington DOL has done for a extended period of time? Is it a newer effort? And what's the focus of your program?
So the efforts in Washington are relatively new. The tribes in the state have had a long history of disputes dating back, you know, since the 1800s, particularly in natural resources and taxation, as well as certain issues that, you know, impact us here at Department of Licensing. My position is a dedicated position devoted specifically to interacting with tribes. It's mandated in state law. The tribes and the governor in 1989 had come to an agreement to work more collaboratively together. They codified in 1999 the requirement for state agencies to have a dedicated tribal liaison position that engages with tribes. And so that is the result of my position.
And when you say to engage with the tribes, I believe in some places of the country, some tribes have the authority to issue their own credentials, to issue their own vehicle credentials, as well as driver credentials. In the case study of Washington State, where's that balance between autonomy of the tribes with needing to work with the DOL for credentials?
In that space, tribes a lot. So we do have tribes in the state who self-procure their own plates and issue their own credentials. We don't have a lot of coordination with them from a formality perspective. We do offer here at our state an opportunity for tribes to procure specialty license plates that are unique to their members. And that is the one area where it would require coordination with our state offices. But typically, tribes have pursued through their own sovereignty the issuance of plates and credentials.
So they're issuing their own driver's licenses as well.
So my understanding is, one tribe is issuing their own driver's license. In the
state. And is there any work with them in terms of how they're testing their drivers and the process they're going through? Because I would imagine even if they're issuing their own driver's license, and maybe this is, you know, more of a question for you, Rick, regardless of where they get their license from, they could operate on any roadway. So even if they have gotten the driver's license through the tribal authorities, it doesn't limit them to those roads.
Right. And I'd be curious, the captain's take on this, because it's not something that we have interacted a lot with tribes, because it's something, because through their sovereign authority, it's something they've pursued without kind of coordinating with the Department of Licensing.
So is it true? I mean, I imagine in Alaska, you know, it's so large and so isolated in many ways. I would imagine you and your colleagues at Roadside pretty much only see Alaska licenses. You may not see a huge percentage of either even out-of-state licenses, let alone of tribal licenses outside of those lands. But that's just Ian not really knowing much about this topic, trying to throw something out to get some reaction.
Yeah, so Ian, Alaska has 230 of the federally recognized tribes, which is just under half, right? There's a significant number of tribal entities in Alaska that we work with. The state road system is actually very limited. It only connects a portion of our communities. The Alaska State Troopers have 41 trooper posts around the state. Only half of them are connected to the road system and would do what traditional law enforcement would look like, driving in a car and responding to calls for service. Mm-hmm. The other ones work out in more rural areas, and we operate in a hub and spoke model, we call it, where troopers will be stationed mostly in a regional hub area with some kind of infrastructure, medical, court system, airlines like small bush commuter planes, to transport people, and then they'll go from there out to the communities and provide law enforcement services. Mm-hmm. And so troopers at the line level are actually interacting with multiple tribal entities at any one time. Mm-hmm. So we have some tribal entities that are on the state road system. None of them yet have engaged the state in their own licensing credentials or license plates. We do see a lot of outside of Alaska, whether it's Canadian or U.S. driver's licenses in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We have a large military presence. We have four very large military installations, two in Anchorage, it's really one now with Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and then Fort Wainwright and Eielson Air Force Base up in Fairbanks. So we have a lot of military personnel, and then, of course, we're a tourist destination, and people actually come to Alaska in the winter, too. Mm-hmm. So most of them in the summer, but we do have a lot of winter tourism as well. So law enforcement's interacting with people from all over the United States and Canada on a regular basis. It's pretty normal for us to run into foreign, not Alaska, driver's licenses, credentials, or license plates.
And so as it relates to working with the tribal authorities and First Nations individuals, what are, in addition to this kind of roadway safety conversation, what are the primary topics you mentioned earlier that, you know, you're working on a lot of different ways with these sovereign governments? What's the relationship? What are the topics?
You know, it really depends on the community. With 230 different tribal entities, everybody's got their own thing that they're concerned about. And so it really runs the spectrum. We have some that are very clear about their desire to be sovereign and to have do their own thing and rule in a way that makes sense to them. And then we have other people that recognize a different relationship with the state of Alaska and really support each other with services and help, mm-hmm. realizing that a lot of that help can come from the state of Alaska. So it really just depends on the region that you're in. And we'll even have two communities next to each other. There's two communities on a river system in western Alaska where one has typically been very sovereign and not wanted to deal with the state. And just a couple miles upriver is another community that's been very welcoming to the state and work really well together. So it really just depends on what's going on in that community at that time. And so it's an ever-evolving relationship with us. Yeah. And what issues are important to those communities? Subsistence hunting and fishing is a big topic a lot with everybody. And then there's other issues, but some of those issues, like I said, depend on the different communities that you're in and what's important to them. Yeah.
You have similar experience, James?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. When this topic of dealing with tribal authorities and communities, I think it's a tendency to, assume we're talking, working with one entity. But we have 29 tribes in Washington, and each of them have their own unique priorities and mm-hmm. positions and concerns. Certain tribes are very interested in natural resources, so we don't hear a lot about it on the traffic safety side. Others are very interested in the fuel taxes, which is certainly within, our purview at the licensing agency. So, I think one of the best practices is not necessarily assuming that each of the tribes have the same interests in tailoring your approach to each individual, the community that you're working with.
So how do you as a state agency that has this suite of products and services, you really have to customize then for each community what it is that they want to use from the DOL. And even though you might be customizing it, what are the common trends? There must be some things that, you know, I see more often than not, we need to work on these particular topics, or they need these products, particularly from the Department of Licensing, whether it's related to actually a driver license, or in the case of Washington, where you've got all sorts of licenses that maybe not traditional all DMVs have.
Right. We do a lot of work with the treaty rights regarding vessels. And so we mm-hmm. have an operating, so as part of our scope of registering boat vessels mm-hmm. And coordinating with the Coast Guard for that information, we have a back office process where we work with tribes to receive, you know, decals as part of those treaty rights, outside of the normal, you know, showing up to our offices and getting, you know, a standard customer service representative help. But that, you know, each of the tribes are in a different place for, you know, for how the responsive they are to, you know, coordinating with us at getting those. So relationship building, I think, is key. I spend a lot of my time, you know, building relationships with tribal partners and tribal members, understanding the needs of the communities, and really understanding which, you know, who in leadership across the various tribes are particularly interested in this topic, because then they will be your key partners to help, you know, help bring about change or bring about coordination.
And I imagine that's probably true for both of you and your counterparts in terms of needing to invest in building that relationship and to have that communication back and forth. How important is it for folks in your position or in the teams that are doing this to have that understanding and training in the culture, the background, the perspective of where they're coming from, which is going to be different than the perspective of the average customer constituent that's coming either into a Department of Licensing for a transaction or from a non-tribal individual that you might be dealing with at roadside or otherwise? To have that training, to understand that background, the heritage of the culture, how does that play into building these relationships?
No, I think the training is so key, because there's definitely a cultural barrier, and there are potential pitfalls for anyone who doesn't have the appropriate training may come into a community and mm-hmm. And not necessarily be aware of best practices. What I would say best practices are typically to listen and hear, right? We're coming in with our own bias that may, you know, be different than what their priorities are. We have different lived experiences. So mm-hmm. So I think listening and understanding kind of where they're trying to understand where they're coming from, but particularly just letting them, you know, say what they have to say. One of the items that we're very mindful of is meeting tribes where they're at. So similar to Alaska, we have in Washington, affiliate is a tribal organizations that are very engaged and active at the state and national level. Particularly affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians, which encompasses Alaska, Montana, Oregon, and Washington tribes. They'll get together and have, you know, issue policy statements, you know, come together on policy priorities, recognizing each tribe has their own kind of different priorities, but as a collective, you know, they can be more effective at changing that policy. So we are engaged with these local tribal affiliation groups, and I think that benefits us as well as them of having open conversation and dialogue.
You know, from a law enforcement perspective, it's unique, right? Where as Alaska State Troopers, most of the time we don't live in these communities with these tribal members, because they're smaller communities. We've got to spread our resources out. And so I'll talk later today in a presentation, but the Kotzebue post of the Alaska State Troopers encompasses an area the size of Ohio, with a sergeant and five state troopers. There's no roads that connect any communities. And so those communities sometimes are small enough that it's really difficult to get a trooper and his family to move from, or his or her family from somewhere else. And so they'll live in the hub community and work there, and the trooper will be assigned multiple communities. Well, they're only in there and out of there, and it could be really easy for a trooper to just go to calls for service to that community. And so what the community sees is the trooper comes in, does an investigation, arrests somebody, and hauls them out. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be fairly negative, right? That the only time you ever see them is to do that. Yes. So, you know, in the last 20 years or so, there's been this trend in law enforcement to build community-oriented policing units. Mm-hmm. As the Alaska State Troopers, I like to say to people, we don't understand what that means. We think that community-oriented policing should be a way that you should conduct yourself and interact with anybody. Mm. It's not a unit. Every trooper is responsible for community-oriented policing. Mm. So troopers should be proactively going to their communities, and they're encouraged to. We have an acronym of an RON, Remain Overnight, and there's payroll codes for that. But troopers are encouraged to go to their communities and stay the night, learn about their communities, ask questions, engage, learn about cultural aspects and the way that the community thinks about things so that they can police in a way that's unique to that community. And it might be different than the community next door. Mm-hmm. But it's the trooper's responsibility to learn how to do that with that particular community and which tribal members happen to, you know, maybe tribal leadership has changed and maybe the flavor of the priorities have been kind of reordered. And it's up to the trooper to be able to understand that and share that with his counterparts in the region so that they're aware of some of those nuances when they go provide policing to that community.
You know, to do that, Rick, requires a level of emotional intelligence and training in listening and awareness that is probably not part of a traditional curriculum for anyone. I mean, not just for a state trooper, but whether it's a state trooper or a DMV program manager or somebody that's, you know, in a traditional bureaucratic driven environment, the idea of being emotionally intelligent and aware to go in and learn things that are not something that someone's going to say, I want to sit down and train you how to do X. But you need to go in and observe what's a tradition, what's a behavior, what's an attitude. How do you prepare a state trooper or anybody with a government background to go in with that mindful awareness, for lack of a better phrase?
Yeah, so at the Trooper Academy in Alaska, we train not just state troopers, but we train most of law enforcement in Alaska are small police departments, and almost all of them come through ours. Anchorage Police has their own academy. Fairbanks has on occasion through the university up there. Mm-hmm. And so because these guys and gals are going out to these rural, remote areas, we like to train everybody in the same curriculum. It's mm-hmm. not just a trooper that gets it because they have to learn how to operate in these environments. Yeah. And then we also do a lot of on-the-job training with state troopers in training them to be able to interact with people. So when you're assigned a rural post off the road system, you're going to get assigned a mentor unofficially, like, training you to do this stuff. There's formal mentor training in law enforcement after an academy. Mm-hmm. You go to the field, Washington, we're going to call it coaching. We call it field training, like a lot of the other United States do. There's some of that happens there, but you get out to these rural communities, you get paired up with a mentor, somebody that's been there for a little bit, mm-hmm. and they learn how to engage and communicate with people, learn how to ask questions and have conversations, yeah. and be curious about what's happening so that they can learn to listen. If you're asking questions of people, you're right. pulling information out, yeah, yeah, yeah. and that's how you teach them how to listen. Nice.
Now, James, Rick's talking about this in the context of having the availability of a workforce to go out and connect with the communities. Is it true in DOL? Are you a one-person shop? Do you have more people on your team to work with the tribal authorities?
Well, I think the bulk of the work is done by our program staff in the various areas that work with the tribe. So we have field tax agreements with tribes to share the field tax revenue that they're collecting, and you know our field tax program primarily interacts with their counterparts on the tribal staff, similar with the vessels, similar with our plates. Are you know the program staff at Department of Licensing does the bulk of the engagement, and my role is primarily relationship management, advising, you know, internally the agency on tribal issues, as well as engaging, you know, tribal leaders to maintain that relationship. But most of the work is done by our program staff at the, who are operating the various, you know, operations.
You mentioned the DOL efforts a little bit newer to have this focus group. Have you had the opportunity yet to see if other states are doing anything similar and if you have counterparts that are leading these type of efforts where you've been able to compare and contrast notes?
There are... we are aware that other states have taken similar approaches to Washington of requiring their agencies and to have, you know, tribal outreach staff. Mm-hmm. Oregon has passed similar legislation where they have a governor, you know, a cabinet level agent, you know, officer at the governor's level to engage with tribes. New Mexico has something similar. Mm-hmm. We're always interested in learning best practices from other jurisdictions that are doing the same work.
Rick, you mentioned before we started recording that you were already having some conversations with some of your counterparts on the law enforcement side, and eyes open, that's different. Tell me a little bit more about some of those contrasts that you're finding as you talk to your counterparts across North America.
Well, one of the things I was talking with one of our DPS attorneys before coming down here, who has had to become kind of an expert in Alaska and tribal relations. And one of the things about laws and jurisdictions that I think most of us have the frame of reference to is it's for an area. Mm-hmm. You know, the city of Oklahoma City, there's a police department that polices there. And there's a group or governing body that creates laws. And there's the state of Oklahoma. And then we've got the United States. It's kind of land-based. And Alaska does it a lot differently. We have one reservation in Alaska. That's it. All the other tribal entities operate differently than we would find on a normal reservation, where that area of land or property is recognized as the tribal area, mm-hmm. and then there's different ways that law enforcement or the state government would interact with that tribal government. And so because we don't have those boundaries that same way in Alaska, it changes a little bit the way that we interact, right? So there's still residents of the state of Alaska. We have cooperative agreements with the Division of Motor Vehicles where we need people in the bush to be able to have a driver's license or ID cards to fly on the airlines because they fly in a jet mm-hmm. with TSA security requirements from Nome and Kotzebue and Dillingham into Anchorage. Well, how do you get those, especially when you're from a smaller community? Mm. So providing DMV services full-time in some of those regions have been very, very difficult. So we've partnered with motor vehicles in Kotzebue Post, I'll use that as an example again, where we are both paying for half of a position. And so that clerical person will do part-time trooper evidence and trooper clerical staff. And then certain hours a week, they're the DMV person for the area, right? Yeah. So we've partnered that way because we both needed half of a person. But how do you do that in state government, right? And so we were able to combine that. So there's a mechanism for us to get the funding paid for to pay for the position. But that's allowed us to put services like the motor vehicles and to provide better services to community as troopers in a rural region so that they can get the things that they need to travel freely, because that's where the larger hospitals are for them to be able to get care or some of the other infrastructure that's needed in Anchorage. And that's a way the state has partnered with other state agencies just to make sure that people in these regions are able to get the services they need, right? And so there's things like that are happening all over the place. We also have agreements with some tribal entities where it's a pilot project where a state trooper will investigate a violation of criminal law, and let's say it's a misdemeanor assault. The trooper will talk with the tribe and the tribal court representatives and then run it through the local district attorney's office, and we may refer that case whole or in part to the tribal court to let them work through the judicial process in a way that makes more sense to them. Mm-hmm. And the state will kind of watch that and then suspend the state's interest in that case. And usually in those agreements, the tribe agrees to like report back to us at least what happened, mm-hmm. so that if we have a case of recidivism or repeat offenses, we can also, the tribe and the state can engage more meaningfully on how to help keep people safe, so that we don't have two entities providing this law enforcement and consequence thing, mm-hmm. but not communicating at the end, which really doesn't help the victim, right? If we're not on the same page. So we're trying that out in a couple of regions, mm-hmm. and we're seeing how that works. So it's just a little bit different than mm-hmm. my counterparts deal with.
And James, in Washington, you know, Rick talked a lot about the partnership between law enforcement and the Alaska DMV. DOL, you mentioned some of the program areas. Is there partnership or work done in conjunction with the Washington State Patrol, or is that something still to be developed?
That's something definitely that's still to be developed. I am aware of cross-deputization that occurs. Unlike Alaska, Washington does have large reservations mm-hmm. that, you know, has jurisdictional issues with, you know, local sheriffs and others. And then so I'm aware that some tribes have opted for cross-deputization to support some of those the jurisdiction authority issues. We have one of the reservations is over 1 million acres. We have two reservations over 1 million acres. So mm-hmm. we're talking, you know, large areas of land that, you know, are, you know, under the jurisdiction of the tribal police force.
Yeah. One of the things in Washington that pushed this along, I believe, was a fairly high-profile court case, lawsuit. Can you tell me anything about Department of Licensing versus Cougar Den and any lessons learned out of that experience?
Yeah, that is certainly at the forefront. So Cougar Den was a case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court in 2018. It is a dispute regarding taxation or the preemption. It's called the federal preemption of the Washington State fuel tax imposed upon a tribe or tribal nation. In this instance, the Yakima Tribal Corporation, owned by a tribal member, was importing fuel from Oregon to the Yakima Indian Reservation. To kind of take it back a little bit, Washington is a cap-at-the-rack state where the tax is due at the time it's removed from the terminal rack or the bulk terminal rack. Mm-hmm. There are other methods of, fuel coming into the state through importation, rail, mm-hmm. over the highway and others. This particular case was regarding a fuel trucked in from another state into the Yakima Indian Reservation. And there, I guess the argument is that fuel was preempted by the right to travel provision in the Yakima Treaty. Now, it was signed in 1855. Now, the treaty of 1855, Washington wasn't a state until 1889, right? And mm-hmm. so this was a agreement that the Yakimas had made with the federal government before Washington was even a state. And now, we're in modern times trying to interpret how mm-hmm. the creation of the state, the creation of the fuel tax, kind of coincides with this agreement that the Yakimas have made with the federal government. Mm-hmm. What the court found was that the right to travel provision within the Yakima Treaty did preempt the importation of did preempt the fuel tax on the importation of fuel. That's created some, it's created some challenges for our IFTA carriers. So IFTA is the International Fuel Tax Agreement jurisdictions, 48 continuous states and the, Canadian provinces. So when a motor, typically under IFTA rules, a truck driver can, use fuel in Washington and then get claim different increments of that fuel in various states.
Right.
Because what the Cougar Den case authorized was the importation of tax-free fuel, there are now fuel stations in Washington who are selling fuel without the Washington tax previously applied to it. And so when an IFTA carrier submits to the DOL expecting a refund for fuel that they've used out of state for their what they assumed was tax fuel purchase, are now may find themselves at a liability for the tax because they have the fuel that they originally purchased did not have the tax imposed on it, and so that has jurisdictional problems for us as well. So, mm-hmm. The Cougar Den one is the Supreme Court ruled, so it's the law of the land. And has created certain challenges for us that, we've had to address specifically with our IFTA carriers. Mm.
And have you heard at all the precedent since it was a Supreme Court decision, has that affected other states and other tribes that you're aware of?
It certainly may, and it certainly will. So when this was being argued before the Supreme Court, 15 states had submitted an amicus brief because they have tribes within their state that have similar right to travel provisions within their treaty. And so I think that is yet to be kind of borne out in litigation, okay. the broader implications of that. But states are certainly observing and what we're doing here in Washington regarding, the after effects of Cougar Den than one because it has implications for their tribal relations.
So we certainly, we've not talked a lot about IFTA on this podcast in the past, but we know a lot of our members that are listening are the IFTA administering agencies. So it's something that maybe anybody listening to this, if you've got IFTA under your umbrella, you may want to dive a little deeper on this one. Interesting. The last thing I want to ask you guys about is one of the things I mentioned earlier, and Rick, you've alluded to it a couple times around keeping these communities safe. And the harsh reality that the fatality statistics show that these individuals are suffering disproportionately. The causes of the crashes, though, are consistent with the universal causes, belts, booze, speed. What do we know about why these communities are being disproportionately impacted by fatal crashes? And what, if anything, can we do as public safety agencies to fight that trend? Have either of you had the opportunity to look at this? Is this part on your radar, or is it, it's also okay to say, hey, we're dealing with the transactional part of the business and haven't been able to get into the highway safety side of it.
Yeah, so I think in Alaska, one of the things that we see regularly is that national trends and data, Alaska usually tends to be an outlier from those things. Mm-hmm. For example, I ran a state traffic team for a couple of years, and our NHTSA grant said that we had to work certain periods of the week, right? Certain days at certain time periods. And in my local area, those time periods did not match when our dangerous drivers or drunk drivers were out on the roads. Mm. And so I had to compile a bunch of data, and we were able to get an exemption for my team to work different hours, mm-hmm. because it didn't follow what the national trends were in a lot of other regions, right? And so, and our activity increased significantly when we made the adjustment to what our local circumstances were.
What do you attribute that to? Because you're talking more holistically about all things Alaska in that statement. What's the difference in the Alaska way of life, for lack of a better phrase, that says we've got impaired drivers at these hours that buck the overall trend?
You know, and I can't speak for the other regions of the state, but at that particular time, but when I was in the Fairbanks region at that time doing traffic enforcement, it just had to do with the local culture of the community. We had two big military bases. We've got a college campus. Mm-hmm. We've got lots of different economic drivers that are bringing people in for different reasons. There was bar closing hours at a certain time, right? And so with NHTSA saying that I had to stay on duty till 6 a.m.
Yeah.
To look for drunk drivers, but all the bars in the area closed at 2, mm-hmm. and it's not a big area, so people aren't traveling very far. So the bar closes at 2.
It's done by 3:30.
Where else are you going to go other than to your friend's house or home? And so there was a significant reduction in traffic after 3 a.m.
Okay, yeah.
And so you've got all these troopers on traffic grant funding driving around.
For 3 hours, waiting for nothing.
And the only thing on the roads at that time of day were taxi cabs and trooper cars.
Right? I thought you were going to say moose and...
There were some of those too, but you know they were kind of out of the way when we were looking for drunk drivers. So I think there's some national trends sometimes that just are a little bit different based on just the experience that you have in Alaska. Light plays a big role. So high noon in other places is at 3:30 in the afternoon in Nome, Alaska, mm-hmm. right? Because it's on Alaska's basically two time zones. There's a huge expanse of mm-hmm. area. And so people tend to naturally go with light rhythms right in their
right.
body.
Yes.
And so when you go to Western Alaska, people tend to get up later in the day mm-hmm. than they do in Anchorage or Juneau. And it has to do with the fact that they are going with their natural body rhythms. And so the community operates on those timetables and not necessarily yeah. what the business world in Anchorage or Juneau are doing. So those are just examples of some of those
unique characteristics that
we operate with when we go out west or we're dealing with some of our rural communities.
And James, I'd imagine in Washington, I know the State Patrol is separate from DOL, and also the Washington Traffic Safety Commission is yet a third agency. So I don't know if you're aware that if they are looking at any of these particular topics as it relates to these communities.
Well, we're certainly aware of the statistics. We're certainly aware of the statistics on Indian reservations. They're tragic. And anecdotally, I grew up on an Indian reservation and had classmates in high school that died from traffic-related alcohol fatalities, and it's tragic every time. It's certainly an area that we have renewed interest in here at Department of Licensing. Many on this call will know my colleague Dan Cook, who's a regular at ANVM. It's certainly a priority of his that we want to look into how we can get the tribal communities to support car seats, DUI accidents. There's various areas of traffic safety that I think are a priority for us that we want to newly begin engaging with communities specifically for this topic.
James, Rick, as we're wrapping this up, for folks that haven't looked at this topic before of working with tribal authorities, what haven't we touched on that if someone was being introduced to this topic, we'd want to make sure they're aware of, they know about, or somewhere where they may want to follow up to get more information? Anything particularly come to mind that we haven't touched on?
You know, Alaska DPS has some higher level tribal liaisons that are familiar with communities and And I know both of them. They work really well. They're in different departments that have different roles and missions. But once again, like as our troopers are interacting with multiple tribal leaders in different places regularly on the daily basis almost, it's really important to just ask questions and get to know people, get to understand what the community's needs are and how we can best serve them. Because they might be a little bit different community to community, and we've got to try to apply the logic to whatever their way of life is to the framework of the state government and what we're trying to accomplish.
And the thing you said in there, Rick, which I think is maybe a misconception, that when you're dealing with the tribal authorities, that maybe you could have this one blanket policy of this is how we're dealing with tribal authorities. And the truth is, you might be underestimating the unique needs of each individual community within that umbrella of tribal.
Absolutely. And the community can change, right? Different tribal leaders can be, can come into power in that,
just or the whole governance culture in that,
and it
community.
Might change the whole culture, right? And I've had communities where I policed it and that had happened, where there might be two very strong families in the community and one's running the city government and the other family's running the tribal government in the community. And it's a smaller community. You've got to learn how to work with both of them to help figure out how to solve some problems that might not even be a trooper's responsibility, but we wind up sometimes being this third party person and helping them kind of work together to resolve some differences.
James, anything we're forgetting about that you would make sure is on the conversation table?
Yeah, I think learning about consultation practices and starting to engage with tribes is and how to do that in a way that is meaningful but also effective is probably the learning gap that I've seen across various state agencies as well as other other jurisdictions. Knowing the placement of the tribal liaison employee is key. I have direct connection to our leadership team, which makes me more effective engaging with tribes. The appropriate training. Also, through consultation, having the right people who are decision makers show up at the table, right? So when you do get tribal leaders in the room, that you can advance the conversation and make meaningful decisions while they're there rather than let's take it back, right? And so I would point to the Washington Governor's Office of Indian Affairs website. Has some great resources on the agreements that have been made in the state between our state government and tribes, as well as some consultation best practices.
Great. James, Rick, thank you for the time today chatting with us about this topic. It was great to introduce it to our listenership, and I'm sure there's going to be more to come.
Thanks so much, Ian.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks, everyone, for listening this week. Thanks to our producers, Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin. Till next week, stay well.
Thank you for joining us for AmbaCast. Hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Get Mobile ID by Get Group North America. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.